Amen. Please be seated. If you came in a little later this morning, you would have missed the announcement that we need to be out of here early this week because of the drama production that is coming in afterward. So we're going to be aimed to be out of this room by 11:45 and out of the building by 12. So afterwards, if you can help, Jesse and the deacons pack up, particularly you kids, if you could help pack up the stuff that's in the classrooms and help get things on the truck, that would be great. And please know we will not make a typical practice of this if we can help it. So thank you for helping out for this week. So if things seem a little bit rushed today, it's because they are. So I know I have to fight the tendency because I am typically, and I was likened by Ernest years ago to God's auctioneer. And those traits may return even more so today. So our chapter, wouldn't you know it, this is the week we preach on two whole chapters. But they're shorter, they're kind of the length of the single chapters we have been covering. So we will be preaching through 1 Samuel 21 and chapter 22. Let's begin here in 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. David went to the priest Ahimelech at Nob. Ahimelech was afraid to meet David, so he said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" David answered the priest Ahimelech, "The king gave me a mission, but he told me, 'Don't let anyone know anything about the mission I'm sending you on or what I've ordered you to do. I have stationed my young men at a certain place. Now, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found.'" The priest told him, "There is no ordinary bread on hand. However, there is consecrated bread, but the young men may eat it only if they have kept themselves from women." David answered him, "I swear that women are being kept from us as always when I go out to battle. The young men's bodies are consecrated even on an ordinary mission, so of course their bodies are consecrated today." So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, for there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from the presence of the Lord. When the bread was removed, it had been replaced with warm bread. One of Saul's servants detained before the Lord was there that day. His name was Doeg the Edomite, chief of Saul's shepherds. David said to Ahimelech, "Do you have a spear or a sword on hand? I didn't even bring my own sword or my weapon since the king's mission was urgent." The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here, wrapped in cloth behind the ephod. If you want to take it for yourself, then take it, for there isn't another one here." "There's none like it," David said. "Give it to me." David fled that day from Saul's presence and went to King Achish of Gath. But Achish's servant said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land? Don't they sing about him during their dances? Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands?" David took this to heart and became very afraid of King Achish of Gath. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. He acted like a madman around them, scribbling on the doors of the city gate and letting saliva run down his beard. "Look, you can see the man is crazy." This is one of the funniest lines in the Bible. King Achish said to his servants, "Why did you bring him to me? Do I have such a shortage of crazy people that you brought this one to act crazy around me? Is this one going to come into my house?" So David left Gath and took refuge in the cave of Adullam. When David's brothers and his father's whole family heard, they went down and joined him. In addition, every man who was desperate, in debt, or discontented rallied around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him. From there, David went to Mizpah of Moab, and where he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother stay with you until I know what God will do for me." So he left them there in the care of the king of Moab, and they stayed with him the whole time David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet Gad said to David, "Don't stay in the stronghold. Leave and return to the land of Judah." So David left and went to the forest of Hereth. Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered. At that time, Saul was in Gibeah, sitting under the tamarisk tree at the high place. His spear was in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him. Saul said to his servants, "Listen, men of Benjamin, is Jesse's son going to give all of you fields and vineyards? Do you think he'll make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? That's why all of you have conspired against me. Nobody tells me when my own son makes a covenant with Jesse's son. None of you cares about me or tells me that my son has stirred up my own servant to wait in ambush for me, as is the case today." Then Doeg the Edomite, who was in charge of Saul's servants, answered, "I saw Jesse's son come to Ahimelech, son of Ahituv, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions. He also gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." The king sent messengers to summon the priest Ahimelech, the son of Ahituv. and his father's whole family who were priests at Nob. All of them came to the king. And then Saul said, "Listen, son of Ahitub." "I'm at your service, my lord," he said. Saul asked him, "Why did you and Jesse's son conspire against me? You gave him bread and a sword and inquired of God for him so he should rise up against me and wait in ambush as he is in the case today?" Ahimelech replied to the king, "Who among all your servants is as faithful as David? He's the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, and honored in your house. Was today the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Please don't let the king make an accusation against your servant or any of my father's family, for your servant didn't have any idea about all this." But the king said, "You will die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family." And the king ordered the guards standing by him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they sided with David, for they knew he was fleeing, but they didn't tell me." But the king's servants would not lift a hand to execute the priests of the Lord. So the king said to Doeg, "Go and execute the priests." So Doeg the Edomite went and executed the priests himself. On that day he killed 85 men who wore linen ephods. He also struck down Nob, the city of the priests, with the sword, both men and women, infants and nursing babies, oxen, donkeys, and sheep. However, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, escaped. His name was Abiathar, and he fled to David. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, "I knew that Doeg the Edomite was there that day, and that he was sure to report to Saul. I myself am responsible for the lives of everyone in your father's family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid, for the one who wants to take my life wants to take your life. You will be safe with me." The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes and ears up here. God's word is not just for the grown-ups to listen to, it's for you. Because God loves you, kids, and he wants you to know that. And he wants you to know how you can show God that you're thankful for his love and how you can love him. So, do you ever ask your parents to help you with something and they say, "I think you need to do this yourself"? Do you like hearing that? Probably not, right? Because something hard and you don't want to do it, maybe you're just acting a little lazy, or maybe it is a little bit hard, and your parents say, "You need to learn how to do this." Is that because they like to be mean to you? "I'm going to make him do it." I don't think your parents ever do that. No, they want to teach you how to do things for yourself so you can get stronger and grow up. What if they'd never taught you how to use the bathroom and they just still left you in diapers? Would that be a good thing? I see heads shaking. Good, that is not a good thing. They love you too much to let you do that, right? So they worked hard to teach you how to go to the bathroom and not in a diaper. Well, God sometimes has us go through hard things. And it's not because he's mad at us or he's mean. He can't be mean. He lets us go through hard things sometimes because it helps us grow and helps us trust him and helps us realize we really need God. Because sometimes when we're feeling strong, we don't think we need God much. But in hard times, that's when you realize, I really do need him. And David is going through some hard times in the verses we read today. And he wasn't handling it well. And then he realized he needed to trust God. And once he does that, as we're going to read a psalm David wrote about this story today, then he realized, I have God on my side. And you have Jesus who died for you so that God would always be on your side, always doing what's best for you, always loving you no matter what. So in hard times, we can say, even though things are going bad around me, God is on my side because Jesus died and rose again so that God would always love me. So when times get tough, remember, always ask God to please help and help you trust him. And when your parents ask you to do it yourself, try to be thankful that they're teaching you, okay? Thank you, kids, for listening. So, how does God sustain our faith? We've been talking so much about not trusting in self and instead trusting in him. How does God sustain our faith? First, he shows us how fragile we are without him. He shows us how fragile we are without him. Second, he shows us just how perfectly he is in control. He shows us how perfectly he is in control. And finally, he shows us how secure we are with him. He shows us how secure we are with him. So I hope David's actions in the first part of today's passage seemed out of sync with what we've seen from David so far, because they are. David is acting out of serious desperation and fear and not relying on the Lord as we've been accustomed to seeing him do. And so he's kind of reminding us of Saul, at least he should. He is doing things that lack integrity. He's doing things that lack courage. And he's doing things that lack wisdom. And we've been amazed at how David has shown so much of that in very difficult times. So we see David starting to rely on self. Many commentators pointed out that the lies he tells to Abiathar, the priest, are really ham-fisted, really foolish. They don't make any sense. David doesn't have any young men with him hiding there, okay? And he was not sent on any kind of a mission. When he shows up by himself, Abiathar says, trembles. And Abiathar, most commentators think it's because he realized David by himself means a falling out with Saul. And if he's coming to me for help, that probably means what ended up happening to him. Okay. David never should have come to him and lied. He should have said, the Lord is with me, but Saul's against me. Can you help? So he's lacking integrity because he's relying on himself. God seems to sanction lies told to Saul throughout the story because it's part of Saul's punishment. But to the high priest? Unacceptable. But he's lacking courage as well. I mean, we are used to seeing David, a boy in a shepherd's uniform with no other weapons, trash-talking the mightiest human in recorded history because he's so convinced of the power of God with him that he's not afraid of Goliath. But he's the opposite here. And he's lacking wisdom. So why would you flee to Gath, Goliath's hometown, carrying Goliath's sword? I mean, this is what Saul does, right? It's the kind of stupid things he does. David has not been acting this way, but you see how, relying on self, he's lost his wits. And he's making really foolish choices. Nothing is working well for David while he's relying on himself. Without God and without relying on the truths that have moved him in the past, you see how fragile David is. As mighty and successful as he's been, it's not seeming to show up at all right now. And please let this highlight the fact that David didn't get where he was because he was so strong or wise or whatever else. Yes, he's a man after God's own heart. But when you see he's not looking at the God who delivered him from Goliath, and when he's only looking at himself, look how weak, foolish, and fearful he is. And those who rely on self, you should be fearful because you do not have what it takes to deal with the world, the flesh, and the devil. And you will see how many failures are going to surround you and close in on you when we choose to look away from the only thing that can give us hope in those battles. It seems that God gets David's attention, and then things start to change. David chronicles what happened to him when he was in Gath in Psalm 56. You see David describe what the Lord has done in his heart through that deliverance from the Philistines. So if you like turning along, reading along, it's Psalm 56, verse 1. "Be gracious to me, God, for a man is trampling me. He fights and oppresses me all day long. My adversaries trample me all day, for many arrogantly fight against me. When I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? They twist my words all day long. All their thoughts against me are evil. They stir up strife. They lurk. They watch my steps while they wait to take my life. Will they escape in spite of such sin? God, bring down the nations in wrath. You yourself have recorded my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? Then my enemies will retreat on the day when I call. This I know. God is for me. In God, whose word I praise, in the Lord, whose word I praise, in God I trust. I will not be afraid. What can mere humans do to me? I am obligated by vows to you, God. I will make my thanksgiving sacrifices to you, for you rescued me from death, even my feet from stumbling, to walk before God in the light of life. So that is the psalm he wrote upon being delivered from the Philistines, and he sees God, I know God is for me, and this changes everything for David. And this is what we must fixate on when we are facing trials. Yes, humans are really seeking to do terrible things to David, but can they do anything eternally to him? Can they rob him of his eternal hope? Can they remove God from the throne? Can they find a way to nullify God's promises? They cannot. So that's why David says, contrary to how we've seen it act in the beginning part of the passage, what can mere mortals do? I have God. And we know God is disposed for us because he's covered us with Christ. So we know, we can say with David, I know God is for me. Doesn't mean he does our bidding, but it does mean what we're going through is not random, unplanned, and God just kind of forgetting to take care of us. Not at all. That leads us to our second point. He shows us how perfectly he is in control. And David contemplates these things. It's almost like he's having his own prodigal son moment. Here I am, acting insane with spittle dripping off my beard, or I could trust God. And you see how much God is in control of everything. And he reminds us of that when the waves are getting higher. We need to be reminded, this is not God neglecting us or forgetting. He's in control even of the storms. So, God is even orchestrating David's and Saul's sin here to fit his own perfect ends. Saul now enters the ranks, several commentators noted this, of the antichrists. I say that plural because 1 John says, yes, antichrist, capital A, is coming, but many antichrists have come because that's anyone who persecutes God's people. Saul has now turned from just a picture of a fool to a sinner, to be self-obsession, to a picture of the powers of darkness, to now, even more pinpointed, he's acting as an antichrist, persecuting God's people. So this is a level of evil we've not seen in Saul yet, and it's just getting worse. If you notice the text, Saul wasn't doing it himself, but he supported it. When Doeg goes to the town of the priests after he's already executed the ones there, it's almost the exact list of things he kills that Saul was told to do to the Amalekites, and he wasn't willing to do it. But he is willing for it to happen to the priests of Yahweh. Unbelievable. But recall that in chapter 2, this annihilation of these priests was prophesied to Eli because of the wickedness of his household. So in 1 Samuel 2, we read this, verse 30. Samuel's telling Eli this. Look, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your forefathers' family so that none in your family will reach old age. You will see distress in the place of worship in spite of all that is good in Israel, and no one in your family will again reach old age. Any man from your family I do not cut off from my altar will bring grief and sadness to you. All your descendants will die violently. This will be the sign that will come to you concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Both of them will die on the same day. We know that it happened, and then Eli died himself upon hearing the news. But this was foretold before. And while it's not okay for Saul to have done this, it's not just chaos reigning. It's not just random evil. God foretold this would happen. It was part of his plan to show how severely he punishes those who misuse his house and oppress his people through it. Don't lose sight of this in your own times of trouble. God is orchestrating everything for our good. Even if we can't see it, even if we never see it this side of heaven, we know his promise cannot fail. And we know he's for us because he loves us as though we are as righteous as Christ. Nothing can change that. So in joining the hopeless cause of the Antichrists, Saul is now going to be mentioned in the same breath as Pharaoh killing the Egyptian male babies, of Athaliah seeking to wipe out the entire Davidic line so that it would never exist. And of Herod, seeking to kill all the male babies in Bethlehem. And while their power and those oppressing people with that power does cause great pain, every one of their projects failed to succeed. Each one of them, one person in these three, one baby, was rescued or escaped. And Moses goes on to lead his people out of Egypt. Joash is rescued from the slaughter of the Davidic line and goes on to lead God's people in following him. And we know what happened with Jesus, who escaped that judgment to be judged by another in our place on the cross and rise again. So while their power caused temporal pain, their plans to thwart God's plan completely failed, even though only one person escaped each time. It's very similar here. One person escapes, Abiathar. We're going to find out the great blessing he ends up being to David in future chapters because he brought with him the ephod, which David could consult the Lord through and be directed instead of being on his own. So remember when these trials are happening, especially when it's someone who is mistreating you. Like, that's the source of the trial. We see God is orchestrating these things. We can even then say with Joseph to his brothers, you intended this for evil, but God intended this for good, the saving of many lives. God is also orchestrating good things here, not just using sin for his own ends to glorify himself. But we see him sending Gad, the prophet, to direct David. We see David now being surrounded with family. They have not been with him, but he's now surrounded by family in the cave. We see him allowing the kindness of all people, the king of Moab. It's no small thing that Ruth from Moab is David's great-grandmother. Many commentators note the fact that this would have been a well-known connection. So how many generations before there is Ruth, and now here God's orchestrating what happened with Ruth this many years later to now care for David's family while he's on the run. He's also preparing David through all these things to be the shepherd king he's called him to be. It's a beautiful picture. You see the text go out of its way to say the kind of people who are now being drawn to David, those in debt, those who are weak, those who are distressed, they're all seeing David as someone who they would find safety in, who would care for them, and he does. This is the kind of king we need. This is very much as we were the picture of Israel with our knees knocking while David won for us and the victory was also ours. We are the picture of those who find safety in the shepherd king, those who can't solve their own problems, who realize that and see that they need someone to do this for them. God is in control in ways we can't ever see. When the Bible pulls back the curtain and shows us in instances like this how his hand is at work, remember that didn't stop when the Bible ceased to be written. It's happening for us now too. Ask God to help us find peace, that he is in control. And this is not random acts of chaos. And finally, God helps sustain our faith and helps us trust in him because he shows us how secure we are in him. When Abiathar fled and arrives with David and tells him of everything that happened, you see David say, stay with me, don't be afraid. For the one who wants to take my life wants to take your life. You will be safe with me. While Saul's ranks are rapidly shrinking, David's are growing. Look at some of Saul's losses here. He's lost David, who was the nation's hero and made Saul look good. He's lost his son, Jonathan, to David's cause. He's lost his wife, who also supports David. His closest security guards right there, his closest guard, the Benjamites he thought were his trusted circle, refused to obey his command to kill the priests. They won't follow him. Most importantly, Saul has lost the Spirit of God that directed him. One commentator said this, all Saul can say right now is, this I know, Doeg the Edomite is for me. While David rejoices in Psalm 56, this I know, God is for me. So David's now up to 400 men, and Saul's support is next to nothing. He now gains Abiathar, as I mentioned, who is going to be a great blessing to him. So he's welcomed the weak, now he welcomes the persecuted, those the Antichrist wants to kill. And in a language very similar to what Christ will say, hey, the world hates me, they're going to hate you, but I will not leave you. He says, hey, you'll be safe with me. The one who wants to kill me is the one who wants to kill you. You will be safe with me. What a beautiful picture there. After David's on the run, acting literally like a madman, he's reminded that God is for him. And now he's not running around in fear, only caring about himself, lying to priests. He's now looking out for those the Lord has sent to him. Because when you are aware that God is for you, you don't have to worry about yourself. You don't have to make it about what you want and what you're entitled to, you think, and all that. You can say, this I know. God is for me. What can mere humans do? Or what can the temporal world do for me or to me that is not going to be taken care of ultimately by the fact that I am redeemed? And my place with him in heaven around his table is more sure than anything in this temporal world. Who can I help? Who can I serve? Who can I protect? Since I have been protected once and for all by Christ. So, the Bible seeks to remind us, to give us comfort in our struggles, that not only has he died for us, but as David is identifying with him, hey, he wants to get me too. You're safe with me. The fact that Christ suffered while he was on this earth, fighting off temptations, fighting off those seeking to kill him before his time, dealing with those who mock and accuse. The Bible reminds us he has suffered like you have. That's why he's able to comfort you so well. In Hebrews chapter 2, the author of Hebrews says in verse 14, now since the children have flesh and blood in common, Jesus also shared in these, so that through his death he might destroy the one holding the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who were held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. For it is clear that he does not reach out to help angels, but to help Abraham's offspring. Therefore, he had to be like his brothers and sisters in every way, so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest in matters pertaining to God, to make atonement for the sins of the people. For since he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are tempted. David is comforting his people, saying, I know what you're going through, but with me you'll be safe, because I'm the one God has chosen to be king. Therefore, I have to be able to live and survive, so I will keep you safe. Obviously, that's a picture of the one who has done that for us, and the author of Hebrews shows us here, why is it worth trusting in God? Why, when times are trouble, or in times of trouble, when you're tempted to think that God isn't loving you, why does that make no sense? Because Christ gave his life to bring you home. He didn't say, I gave my life to give you an easy time on earth. He warned us the opposite's going to happen. But as bad as it gets, and it is bad, bad things happened to the people of God in this book, but they didn't shut down his promise that the Shepherd King would keep them safe. The Shepherd King would sit the throne and ultimately point ahead and be the ancestor of Christ, who will not just comfort us during the storm now, but bring us home someday so that we can have confidence now and not be afraid of what the temporal world throws at us, but instead say with David, this I know, God is for me. Take that to heart. Ask God to help you be able to say those words and mean it and experience the peace that David has when his circumstances have not changed. He's still on the run. He's still hunted down. But now, remembering that God is for him has changed his whole outlook and given him peace. Pray that God does that for us as well. Elders and